Hello and welcome to Sight and the Sound's Veterans Day Special. Today we'll hear from those who served and those who grew up during the Second World War. We've chosen to focus on this time in history, as the living voices of these people will soon fade into memory. You will hear excerpts from speeches by Prime Minister Churchill, Presidents Roosevelt and Truman, clips from movies and music remembered by our interviewees. And I have the privilege of reading extracts from the journal of John Rudolph Carswell, known to friends and family as Rudy.
Sentimental journey home. Sentimental journey.
Let's begin our journey across the Atlantic in Great Britain. It's 1939. And Prime Minister Churchill is addressing his people.
We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender, and if, which I do not for a moment believe, this island or a large part of it were subjugated and starving, then our empire beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British fleet, would carry on the struggle until, in God's good time, the new world with all its power and might steps forth to the rescue and the liberation of the old.
There'll be bluebirds over the white cliffs of Dover.
When war broke out in Europe, Moya O'Neill was only 5 years old. Her memories are of the London Blitz and the air raid shelters that became her childhood bedroom.
And so as soon as we heard the sirens, I would be asleep in bed often because they came at night. My father would rush into my bedroom, grab hold of me, wrap me in a blanket, and run with me to where my godparents' house was, two doors down. And they would come out of their house, and we would all go into the shelter to sleep. We had five bunks in there. My godparents were on one side and my parents on another, and I slept with my head between two of the bunks. And I do remember that the walls, which were concrete, used to get a lot of condensation on them during the night. Mm-hmm. And I remember putting my hand on the wall and feeling the water. We had to black out all the windows so that no light. People made black curtains so that the lights from inside couldn't be seen by the planes when they went over. Mm-hmm. Because the planes used to come over from Germany, and so they went over West Wickham en route to London, which was where they were primarily doing their bombing. On the way back, they would, if they had bombs over, to lighten the load, they would just let them go over wherever so that the plane wouldn't need as much fuel to get back to Germany. I also remember hearing the radio going, because sometimes Churchill would be speaking and everybody would listen to him, of course. And I used to sleep until the morning when the siren would go, the all clear would go. Mm-hmm. We'd all come out. When I went to school, we had to have a gas mask. I remember how that smelled. It was very rubbery. Mm. And had to take that to school. Mm. When I was at school and the siren went during the day, we used to go down to a shelter, and we weren't allowed to leave until our parents came and picked us up from the shelter. Mm-hmm. The only thing I remember about the shelter is that we used to have big tins of biscuits. I don't remember what we had to drink, or if we did have anything to drink, but I remember those big silver cans of biscuits. Then it got where it was the raids were so frequent that we couldn't go to school. It was just a waste of time. But every time my mother went shopping, she had to take the ration book, and they'd cut out coupons for butter or the things that were rationed. Butter, eggs. We had apples because we grow apples and pears in England. But bananas, well, they were very, very scarce. You rarely would see anything imported. I was very afraid during the war of something happening to her or me being separated from my parents. I remember a lot of fear. Mm. I remember one time my mother, we were walking down our street, and my mother pushed me onto the floor and onto the pavement and laid on top of me because the bombers were going over the top in case I got hit. In the mornings, it wasn't at all uncommon to find shrapnel all over the yard. Children would go out and pick up bits of shrapnel. We had bomb craters would be in the field at the back of us. That would happen sometimes. You realize how close you got to a direct hit. If a house down the street got bombed, particularly with the incendiary bombs, they would call them doodlebugs. And they were like small bombs. And they would usually, they just drop them. That's when they were unloading. And so the roofs would get on fire. And so all the men would call, you know, down the street, fire down here, and everybody would rush out. My father, because he didn't have a helmet, used to put a colander, a vegetable strainer, over his head, which we all laughed about. We weren't at all sure it was much protection, but he used to put that on his head and race down the road. Center of the town had a town square, and we danced all around the town square on D-Day. There was a lot of, you know, festivity.
Tomorrow, just you wait and see. Again, don't know where, don't know when, but I.
Burl Hodge was 13 when Prime Minister Churchill made his historic speech announcing war in Europe. Burl lived in the middle of the bombings in London before evacuating with her mother to Cornwall. She returned briefly to London as a young woman of 17, by then engaged to an American soldier. Burl left England for America as a war bride.
Drive the dark clouds far away.
I remember one time there was a mine that had come down. And you know how our gates used to be the metal gates? Mm-hmm. It was swinging on this gate, and it had the most beautiful green silk chute on it, all made of pure silk with cording on it. And the guys came to defuse it, and they gave us kids this silk piece, so we all had a cut it up and have a piece each. When I think about it, I think, my God, we could have got killed. My 13th birthday, I'll never, ever forget. We spent that down in the basement with almost a 24-hour day alert. We had gone down with the sirens going, and we were there for hours before the Eau Claire. And no, of course, nobody showed up to my birthday party. We had it down there. And my sister was coming home from work. She worked in the city. And she had stopped by the jeweler. She wanted to pick me up a cross and chain. And she didn't come home, and she didn't come home, and she didn't come home. And my mother was worried sick. She said, I'm sure something's happened. But eventually she did get home. And like she said, the siren had sounded, and everybody had to take go into a shelter of some kind.
Will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long.
Because I think we stuck it out for the first year, I think, before they decided to ship us out. Mm-hmm. And we didn't know where we were going. We had not a clue. They stuck us on these trains first thing in the morning, and we kept going all day long. And it was getting dark, and was starting to pull in a siding, and I could smell fish, and I could hear seagulls. And I said to my mom, I said, you know, Mommy, I think we're at a seaside somewhere. Because you couldn't see, it was pitch dark, it was a blackout and everything. It was a billeting officer, and his job was to go to the houses and find out how many rooms you had, how many people you had in your house. And if you had an extra bedroom, you were given an evacuee, whether you wanted it or not. Mm. And it was pretty, pretty awful. Mm. And these people were really nasty. Oh. I mean, some of them were really, really mean. My mother didn't last. She got very sick probably about a month after we got down there. We had to put her in the hospital, and she had a stroke, and by February she was gone. But anyway, make a long story short, I was put in two or three different homes. The billeting officer himself took me in. He asked his wife, he said, I tried her in two or three different houses. It's not working out. And they had no children. And he said, I would very much like to be able to take her in. Mm-hmm. So I stayed with them, and they took two more evacuees from Plymouth. Mm-hmm. And the three of us were there for quite a while. And I probably three years or so, because I didn't get married until 45. So probably about 4 years.
Senators and representatives, I have the distinguished honor of presenting the President of the United States.
Mr. Vice President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Senate, of the House of Representatives, yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. A state of war between the United States and the Japanese Empire.
I met my husband down there. He had relatives down there. So I met him down there, and he was stationed in Norwich at the time. And he said, well, this is going to be hard. Why don't you come back up to live in London? So I went back up to live with my cousin. And I got right in on the buzz bombs and the rockets. You counted to 10, I think it was, and then the thing would go. And once it went, you knew you were safe, But I said, it was scary. It was scary. I'll never forget. I was with my future husband, and we were down in London going to a movie. There was magic abroad in the air. And there was the old telephone kiosk, the red ones, was on the other side, and there was a guy in there with the phone in his hand. And one of these things hit. And we look across, and he's still standing there with the phone and nothing else. Everything else that was there was gone.
Gordon Laird was 17 when he joined the American Navy. He was to see battle in the Pacific on board an LSM, landing ship medium. Gordon served as a second-class signalman, working to transport men, supplies, and equipment onto the beaches of enemy territory, under fire from Japanese fighter planes above.
October of 1943, and I was going to be 18 in November, so I joined the Navy in October, and then went off to boot camp, which was in Newport, Rhode Island, and was there for 8 weeks. LSMs were produced because they had trouble with LSTs at D-Day. They would get in on the beach and be sitting ducks and couldn't get off, and then they would really get in trouble. So we were about two-thirds the size. We were 203 feet long. We had 55 men and 5 officers. And they built 500 of them in the country. It's amazing to think that they built 500 of them so quickly. Our ship was made at the Drevo Shipyard in Wilmington, Delaware, and commissioned at the Philadelphia Navy Yard, which was an experience too. But anyway, we formed up into crews, and then were sent to the Philadelphia Navy Yard for the commissioning of our ship. Our ship was commissioned on the 4th of August of 1944. After that training was finished, we started for the Pacific, went down, stopped at Key West, stopped at Panama Canal, and then from the Panama Canal to the Society Islands, it was 16 days of nothing but land and nothing but water and sky.
We joined the Navy to see the world.
And what did we see?
We saw the sea. We saw the Pacific and the Atlantic.
January 4th, 1945, we had the Lingayen Gulf invasion. That's the northern part of Luzon. And we were there D-Day. I think we were there right even before the first wave came in. And we were the first wave on the beach, and fortunately we had lots of air raids and so forth, but came out fine. And we were there for a week, taking the men off of troop ships and equipment, tanks, trucks, bringing them in on the beach. And of course there was a lot of firepower at that point, a lot of action. And bombing and so forth. And actually, I didn't know it at the time, but this is the area where MacArthur was coming through the surf and up onto the beach. And we weren't close enough to see him, but somebody told me about it later. And after the Lingayen and the Gulf invasion, of course, that was in January of 1945. We did a lot of work out of Subic Bay. Now, Subic Bay was fairly close to Manila. I remember as we would sit in the harbor in Subic Bay, the Jolly Roger B-24 squadron would come in over our heads in the morning and would be going out for bombing on Japan, of course, and then they'd coming back in the evening. It was quite a sight. And then, of course, we were in and out of that area all of the time, up until the time that the war ended in August, 15 of 1945. And right after that occurred, we got our orders to take the first load of occupation troops to Japan.
This is the journal of J.R. Croswell, Rudy, sworn in March 18, 1944, service number 9318834. July 16, 1944. We got our orders. Report to receiving station Navy Yard, Philadelphia, to pick up our ship. LSM, that means landing ship medium, 217. We were in crew 7171, unit 504. Arrived in Philly the 17th of July around noon. Hung around here for a month. So all the Phillies and the Cards play ball. Marguerite came to see me around the 1st of August. Had a wonderful time with her.
Marguerite left the 7th of August for home. How I hated to see her leave. She's a wonderful wife. A lot of hard work on the ship. Left the 10th of August for Norfolk. August 31st, 1944 to September 5th, 1944. Last trip home. Really enjoyed it. September 28th, 1944. Left Norfolk for Key West, Florida at 0800 hours. Sea was very rough around Cape Hatteras, North Carolina. Ship rocked and rolled. Got seasick. Passed Savannah, Georgia, Saturday p.m. The coast of Florida was very pretty. Miami especially. I'm thinking of Jackie today as it is her birthday. I go back to 1937 and think of her mother, too. On radar watch, picked up two subs. Naturally, we were all excited as a Liberty ship was sunk only 10 days ago in this particular vicinity. Albert Schuttenberg enlisted in 1937 at the age of 17.
May or June of 1937, I was 17 years old. It was during the Depression time, and everybody in the house wasn't eating too well, so I joined the Army. And that was the old, what they call the old Army, and there were only really two kinds of people in that. Those the cops were looking for and those that were hungry. I was one of the hungry ones. They put me in an infantry outfit. I was with the 40th Regimental Combat Team. Mm-hmm. And we went into North Africa in the invasion. And I stayed there. I got hit a few times. And I stayed there until they shipped me back to the States. We went in there in 44. But there wasn't very much resistance. There was some resistance to kind of slow us down. Like I said, I got hit twice. My chin, which you can't see anymore, and my stomach. And that's pretty much it. I had 400 Italian prisoners. In one instance, they sabotaged the furnace, and it blew up on me and burned all the side of my face and the inside of my arms. And they were the hardcore Italians. One was an officer, one was a sergeant. And they were going to make their mark one way or the other. So then I had to walk about a mile to an aid station, and they gave me a shot of morphine in the stomach, then put me in a French hospital there outside of Port Leone. And I stayed there until I kind of healed up, you know, and then I went back again. And those Italian prisoners that did the bomb, one was an officer and one was a sergeant. The other Italians grabbed them and they cut their throats and they threw them on the barbed wire. The most of them were very pleasant. In fact, I think some of them seemed to be happy that they weren't up back there in Germany or back there in Italy under the German rule, you know, under the German occupation. I was with the 11th Airborne Division at Fort Campbell, Kentucky. That time was we were the first organized troops to be used on the atomic experiments at Las Vegas. We were in foxholes. I forget how many yards away we were from ground zero, but we could hear the plane, and as the plane came over, we could hear the bombardier and the pilot talking, and they were getting ready to drop the bomb. You could hear them say, you know, bomb bay doors open, and they dropped the bomb, and we were sitting in these foxholes, and we had with our back to the blast, and even below ground, we had our eyes covered with our hands, and you could see every bone in your hands from the radiation when the bomb hit. First of all, we stood there and watched the ball of fire. It just sat on the desert floor, and it slowly rise until it become way up there where the mushroom was. And one of the strange things was that on the top of the mushroom, an ice cap forms. You could hear the bomb blast as the sound of the resounding blast bouncing off all the plateaus around, you know, and then the wind come in on us, and then the wind was sucked out past us again. And then we finally marched into ground zero, and there were a number of animals and houses that were there, and they were all leveled, and the cows and the sheep. The cows were burnt pretty bad. The sheep were, their fur was burnt, but they seemed to be able to stand it pretty well. The sand had all turned to glass.
Oh, wow.
So that every step you took, you heard this crunch, crunch, crunch thing, but it melted all the grass. That's why they had to get rid of our clothes and stuff, our shoes, everything. And every one of us wore what they called dosimeter badges, to show the amount of radiation we managed to pick up there. They took everything away and issued all new stuff.
I'm Scott Arthur, and you are listening to Sight into Sound's Veterans Day Special. And you're listening to the voices, music, and movie choices of veterans and those who grew up during that time. I've been reading and will continue to read excerpts from the journal of John Rudolph Carswell, who served on board Landing Ship Medium, that's LSM 217, from 1944 to 1946. November 21st, 1944. We are in the Solomon Group. Plenty of patrolling on. We should be at Tulagi in about 45 minutes from now. Weather is clear. Planes towing sleeves and guns. Shells are busting directly above us. Day is very young yet. Wish I could get some soil from Guadalcanal and carry it home. Arrived at Tulagi at 11:30 hours. November 23rd, 1944. Today, we celebrated Thanksgiving. Had an excellent dinner. Turkey, sweet potatoes, Irish potatoes, olives, jelly, cranberry sauce, rolls, iced tomato juice, coffee, mincemeat pie, fruitcake. Went on Liberty on Turner City Isle. Saw a picture, Wallace Berry rationing. Enjoyed same immensely. November 25th, 1944. Took my test for Radar Man 3rd class last night. Hot all day. Went to show tonight. Gene Tierney and China Girl. Real good. Had beer before show and ice cream after. Got up at 0500 hours this morning to go on gun firing range. Lots of rumors going around about 10 LSMs being bombed by Japs on the way to Admiralty Isle, our destination. Got a haircut this afternoon. December 3rd, 1944. Arrived in harbor off Manus around 8:30 a.m. This place is full of all kinds of ships, battleships, etc. It's very hot here. Lots of planes. No mail yet. December 9th, 1944. Pulled into harbor early this a.m. Ships everywhere, especially landing craft, LST. And there are other LSMs here, too. The beach is cluttered with wrecked Higgins boats. And the trees are shot all to pieces. Don't know what's ahead of us. Hoping for best is all. December 25th, 1944. Got up at 3:30 a.m. for watch. Went to church services at 10 a.m. Lay around all day, still hot. I would give all I have or ever hope to have to the Navy just to be home. Doesn't seem like Christmas at all. Wonder what they're doing at home. It's 9:15 p.m. here and 8:15 a.m. there. It doesn't seem like Christmas at all. Just another day. I live today thinking of yesterday and dreaming of tomorrow.
Gotta take that sentimental journey.
December 30th, 1944. Had first experience in Jap air raid last night at 24:30 hours. Plane was covered with searchlights and gunfire, and it looked like Christmas or 4th of July fireworks celebration. The plane seemed to explode in the air and come to an end in about 15 seconds after it was hit. The entire crew really pleased at the sight. And frankly, so was I. Just got our instructions on the invasion. It'll be the 9th of January, 1945, at 10:30 a.m. Leaving at 1600 hours today in a large convoy. No more sleep now. Let's hope for the best. Got package from Mama. 4 cans and 1 letter dated 12th of November. Was I happy? And still am. In 1942, Japanese Americans were placed into internment camps. The Army approached these American citizens and asked for volunteers to join the Military Intelligence Service, initially as linguists helping with interrogation of Japanese prisoners, and then actual service in Asian countries. One of those first to volunteer was 19-year-old George Nakamura. His son Gary relates one particular story about his father's service.
He volunteered in November of 1942 with a group of 31 other young men, so 32 total. And that was the very first group that volunteered from Gila River Relocation Center or internment camp where the Japanese Americans were interned. They were rushed kind of early in the morning around, I think about, he told me about 5 a.m. or so. They kind of got the group of 32 young men and then, you know, put them on a bus and then on a train to go to the training site. And it was kind of done in early in the morning because there was some resentment within the camp for, you know, these young men volunteering when they were interned in an internment camp, you know, where they were taken out of California and their soldiers guarding with guns, right? So there was some opposition about that. His mother had given her a blessing to him right away when he told her that he wanted to volunteer. So within the family, there was full support for my father volunteering. By the way, so the 32 young men were taken out of the camp, and they went up to Minnesota, and a place called, do you remember, Camp Savage?
Camp Savage, yes.
Right?
Yes.
There's a training site, Military Intelligence Service Language School, and it was up in Minnesota called Camp Savage. Towards the end of the war, I think this was in 1944, the fall of 1944, he was sent on a covert mission, actually by himself, to cross the enemy lines, the Yellow River up there. And that was really, you know, where there was a lot of frontline activity. The reason why he was sent was to go and bring back, help rescue a downed U.S. Air Corps, Army Air Corps pilot that was shot down by the Japanese. He was sent over there, and he was dressed in kind of, you know, Chinese, you know, civilian clothes. And he had the assistance of local, you know, friendly Chinese people. He had some injuries, you know, to the head and to his body. So he had to be taken out of that area. My father had the assistance of some of the local people there, and they had a use of a donkey. And so they helped move the wounded soldier. They had to wait for several weeks, you know, for the right timing to get more help to bring him back all the way. It was a mission that I think it was probably one of the most dangerous missions that he went on during the war because he was sent by himself, you know, behind, yeah. I mean, go behind enemy lines. When he got to the wounded soldier or the airman, this man's name was Lieutenant John Wood, but he didn't believe that my father was an American soldier. So he thought that he was possibly a Japanese soldier or Chinese, you know, Chinese civilian. But he was very skeptical that, you know, my father was American. Dad, you remember when you first met Lieutenant Wood and he didn't believe that you were an American soldier, right?
Uh-huh.
And then after he heard you swear in English, he finally believed that you were an American soldier.
Uh-huh.
You know, and then they actually became, you know, fast friends after that. And they were kind of hiding out until the timing was right to bring him back across the river. And there's a very touching story about Christmas of 1944. There were a group of Chinese students who, I believe, perhaps they were going to like a Christian university maybe. But they knew some Christmas carols in English. So, and they knew that my father and a soldier were hiding in, you know, this one house. So they actually came over and they sang them Christmas songs. So my father told me, you know, when they heard that, both him and Lieutenant Wood, you know, teared up. And, you know, it's very, very touching to have that kind of kindness shown to them, you know, during the Christmas season. After the new year, they were able to get back to the Red Army headquarters, and Lieutenant Wu was airlifted back out to, I believe, towards southern China, Chongqing area. They didn't see each other after that. Many years after the war, they were able to get in touch with each other, so they corresponded.
January 2nd, 1945. Still underway with convoy. At general quarters last night. Two Jap planes, no gunfire. Another convoy came astern of us today. Really a sight to see, so many ships. DEs and destroyers dropping ash cans for subs. Today is the day. 1 week from now. Can hardly wait. Conditions still crowded. Weather very hot. January 6, 1945. General quarters twice last night. Convoy attacked around 6 a.m. this day. We saw reflection and gunfire. Officers are quite jittery. The crew is very calm. Passed an active volcano tonight. January 9, 1945. Up at 03:30 hours this morning. Arrived at Lingayen Bay early. I have never seen so many ships, battleships, destroyers, cruisers. They started heavy barrage on the beach before going in. Been here 3 days, bombing hard. Jap planes came over, but very high. We hit the beach at 10:30 hours, about an hour after the first and 12th wave. Higgins' boat hit first, no resistance at all. Heavy gunfire by our ships all the time. Saw a destroyer with all the top mast off. We put our load off after the second landing, reloaded and hit again after noon, and loaded again, but it was too dark to land a small craft. The Japs are coming out under boxes and throwing hand grenades at our ships. Our night watches are carrying loaded rifles with orders to shoot. Hit the sack at 21:30 hours. No GQ until the next day. January the 10th, 1945. Hit the beach at sunrise this morning. Unloaded our load, soldiers, tanks, trucks, etc. Reloaded this morning with gas. Also trucks and supplies. It was quite hard loading as the ship beat up against our sides. And their loader on boom was an amateur on the job. Still having Jap planes coming over. We're now in the bay awaiting beaching orders. And the beach is buzzing with activity. Destroyers are bombing hills now and everything seems to be under control. Had a beer this afternoon, and was it good? It's now about 1,500 hours. just waiting and expecting anything. Hey, yesterday some big shot must have come along, for they took pictures of him. It was either MacArthur or Jap prisoners. January the 11th, 1945. Still in bay. Jap planes still coming over. We never beached with our load of gasoline and supplies because the Japs are shelling the beach. Of the first 10 LSMs to hit the beach, 8 were hit out of the 10. The 219 was shelled last night and 18 hurt and 1 killed. We can see the shells falling and where they're coming from, and destroyers are shelling those positions. We unloaded our supplies this PM. We rolled out drums of gas on the beach and then got out. Had enemy raids tonight by Jap planes. Have watch for Jap boats. January the 12th, 1945. Always awakened by Jap raids. As yet, I have failed to see any damage done. Read a book, The Man from Sing Sing. Enjoyed it. Read while on gun watch. We have orders to pull out at 1600 hours. We're about a half a mile from the beach, and I can see the Jap mortar fire hitting the beach. Our men work right on, and the beach is all lit up, even when the enemy aircraft is approaching. Finally got underway at 1700 hours in a good-sized convoy. We don't know where we're going. All praying and hoping for mail. The 442nd Regiment is the most highly decorated World War II regiment in the American Army. The 100th is known as the Purple Heart Regiment. Both are made up of Japanese-American soldiers, volunteers from the internment camp in America and from Hawaii. Tommy Okabayashi was one of those determined to prove his loyalty to the United States and to live up to the regiment's mottos, "Live with honor, die with dignity, and go for broke."
Outside the barracks, by the corner light, I'll always stand and wait for you at night. We will create a world for two. I'll wait for you the whole night through. For you, Lily Marley. For you, Lily Marley.
And I was in a cannon company, which was a supporting team. We had 6 guns, 105 howitzers, and two was assigned to each battalion. So wherever the battalion moved to, 2 of our guns always followed them. And so there were 6 guns, there was 3 battalions, so there was always 2 of them following each battalion. So our company battalion always worked together. They had their combat quite a bit in France. And that's where the 442 helped rescue the lost battalion of the Texas 36th Division.
Marching in the mud and cold, and when my pack seems more than I can hold.
When we was in northern France, we was in an outpost. Of course, I was just the driver for the officer and radio operator. And that's where we encountered a PT boat. We was right waterfront. And we took over the shift at, I think, 7 or 8 o'clock. Anyway, it was a day shift. And by that time, I heard a noise, and it sounded like a motor. So I walked out the balcony, and I see a boat out there. So the lieutenant and the radio operator started shooting, and it came back. It was going back to Italy. You could see we was at France, but you could see Italy. We was watching the Italian border. So they fired quite a bit of rounds, and it turned around and came back. Well, we were 16 stories high on the observing board, so we came down. By the time we came down and hit the floor by the waterfront, well, they hit it back out. Well, by that time, well, then we start shooting again. So they came back. They returned, and there was two, well, I guess you call them sailors. They was running the PT boat. The most city place, there was nothing left. They just, building was just tore down, bombed up. Didn't have no good roads. Had bomb craters. And that's, well, it wasn't a pretty sight.
My love for you, when you my might, I'm warm again. My path is light. It's you, Lily Marley. It's you, Lily Marley.
April 1st, 1945. Today is Easter. Very beautiful day, but so hot. Left around 10:30 a.m. in LCM for the beach. Passed all sorts of Jap ships sunk. On one we saw an old cannon mounted. Hit Manila around 11 a.m. What a sight. The wharf or dock was in ruins, and the beautiful buildings were gutted and burnt out. Nobody could imagine what it was like unless it's seen. The people were all busy cleaning the buildings out, and hundreds of cars wrecked and burned. Manila was a beautiful city of 1 million people, but now it's a heap of ashes. People there are very short of food, and cigarettes can buy anything. Where will I be next Easter? I hope home. April the 5th, 1945. Subic Bay, alongside LSM 169, which was hit by a mine. Hit on the port side by ship's office. What a hole! It burned for 4.5 hours. Men left the ship, and the storekeeper was never found. Killed a score or more of soldiers, and many burned badly. It'll have to cut away from the convoy and rebuild. The 22 had a bad time, too. When these LSMs are hit, it hurts. April 14th, 1945. Still in bay. Heard of Roosevelt's death Friday morning. Don't hardly know how I felt, but certainly hate to know he's dead. All very disappointed because of no mail. The last we got was March 26th. May 8th, 1945. Alongside Leyte. It rained today. First I've seen it in a long time. No mail. The boys went on Liberty in Subic City this afternoon. The war has ceased in Europe. This is wonderful news. It'll be so much better when the same thing can be said out here.
My fellow Americans, Supreme Allied Commander General MacArthur and Allied representatives on the battleship Missouri in Tokyo Bay. The thoughts and hopes of all America, indeed of all the civilized world, are centered tonight on the battleship Missouri. There, on that small piece of American soil, anchored in Tokyo Harbor, the Japanese have just officially laid down their arms. They have signed terms of unconditional surrender. 4 years ago, the thoughts and fears of the whole civilized world were centered on another piece of American soil, Pearl Harbor. The mighty threat to civilization which began there is now laid at rest.
August 15th, 1945. The war has ended. We heard the news at 0800 this morning while at muster. It was 1900 or 7 p.m. at home when it broke here. I humbly thank God for granting us this victory and his constant care of us. We were, and still, very undeserving. We are all very happy the war is over. Home and loved ones are uppermost in our minds. And again, I can humbly say, thank you, God. September 4th, 1945. The biggest event of the day is that censorship of mail has been impounded. Now we can appreciate VJ Day. I can hardly write. I was so thrilled and have been cramped so long by others reading my personal mail. Got three letters from Wright. September the 11th, 1945. Raining in torrents day and night. Dragged anchor. Nothing unusual. Our flotilla is here. We were ordered to Japan for the invasion around the 15th of September. Captain told me yesterday. He saw the orders while in Manila. War news is all we hear now. It's very tiresome. We want to go home, that's all. November 21st, 1945. Left our ship at 09:30 today and took LCM to the beach. Really hated leaving the boys. Only wished all were going. Got to base around 10:15. Caught a bus to the receiving station. November 22nd, 1945. Thanksgiving Day. There's so much to be thankful for. All I can say is thank you, God. Our dinner was perfect. Given cigarettes and candy and chow and got some mail. Saw an excellent USO show and a movie afterward. December 24th, 1945. Stayed around Camp Shelton and went through all the stuff to become a civilian. It wasn't worth the bother. Nearly froze to death and caught a very bad cold. I received my official discharge at 11:30 hours and now am a civilian. Discharge number C2187106, Series C. December 25th, 1945. Also, as to be home for Christmas Eve, I left at noon and made good time to Danville, Virginia. It was dark and began to snow and rain and sleet. And the pavement was very dangerous when I hit Winston-Salem. And finally, I made it to Moxville and 12 miles from Statesville. I had to stop. Couldn't go any further. No invasion was as dangerous as this ride. No chains. It was a nightmare. Finally, I got to Statesville, and all the road transportation was at a standstill. So I stayed all night and got a train the next morning, and it was 2 hours late. I arrived in Morgantown around 9 a.m., and Alvin brought me home. And all I can say is home was all I expected, and then more. Final entry. Today is the 16th of January, 1946, Wednesday, and I will now close this book. I am very thankful God took care of my family and brought me home to them. You have been listening to Moya O'Neill, age 5 when war broke out in Europe. Burl Hodge, evacuated from London at the age of 13 and a war bride at the age of 17. Albert Schuttenberg, enlisted in 1937 at the age of 17. Gordon Laird, enlisted in 1944 at the age of 17. Tommy Ukabashi, enlisted at the age of 18. George Nakamura, enlisted at the age of 19. I have had the privilege of reading from the journal of John Rudolph Carswell, a former comrade-in-arms of Gordon Laird, one of the veterans you heard today. Both served on board LSM 217. We proudly dedicate this program to all those who served in World War II. Thank you. My name is Scott Arthur. The producers for today's program were Maxine Lennon and Jim Martinez.
This has been a production of Sight and Sound Radio, Houston, Texas.
All thanks for the memory of all you flying men. We can't remember when we've had more royal treatment. Hope we'll soon be back again. And thank you so much. All thanks for the memory of pilots zooming planes through navigators' lanes, you gunners, ground crews, bombardiers who further freedom's gains. We thank you so much. Bonds are a way most effective to help these men reach their objective. Look ahead with a freedom perspective. Let's all pitch in. We're out to win. Ladies and gentlemen, to Colonel Estabrook, Major Becker, Lieutenant Kuhn, and all the officers and men who helped us with our broadcast here at Patterson Field, and all you fellas over at Lockburn Field where we played last night, we want to say thanks for the whole gang. Good night, everybody.